Good morning, everyone. So we're going to continue with our Joseph story today, and we're going to be thinking about what it means for Joseph to be a leader. We're kind of getting to the point now where there's some significant things that are going to be happening to Joseph, which will have an impact on the known world, really, at that time. So in a second, I think we'll have the slides up, but I'll just give you a little bit of a taster of what's to come. Let's just go back to our very first session. We were thinking about Joseph the dreamer. Do you remember Joseph as a teenager and what he was like? A complex situation, a family that was slightly dysfunctional, and also a very proud owner of a fantastic coat, if you remember the coat. But this was a time when Joseph was beginning to mature and to grow. And it was apparent that he had a very special gift that God had given him. And at times he used it, not always in quite the right way, but God was at work in his life, beginning to form this young man. And then, of course, the next Sunday, we thought about Joseph the slave. I think this was one we did in our small groups. A difficult point for Joseph, really, I think, in many ways. A time of family betrayal, pain, disappointment, hardship, injustice. And yet in the midst of all this, we discover that the Lord was with Joseph. That lovely term suddenly appears in his story. The Lord was with Joseph. And as he started to work and develop his skills, we can see him growing in maturity and his character developing as he makes some moral decisions that are right for him. But then it all goes wrong again, doesn't it? And the next Sunday, we were there in prison with Joseph. Forgotten, abandoned. I wonder how he felt at that point in his life. But there again, we see God at work. That phrase, the Lord was with Joseph, appears again. And he begins to use his gifts of dreaming and interpreting. And he ministers, doesn't he, to his fellow prisoners and makes a difference to their life. God was working with Joseph in the most unlikely place. And so we join him today. We're in chapter 41 of Genesis. If you want to grab your Bibles, you might find it helpful because I'm going to get you to do a little bit of the work this morning for the sermon. So we're in Genesis 41. And we come to the point in his story where something really significant happens. It all changes almost overnight. And we're brought into this really important, powerful space in the Egyptian kingdom and into the presence of Pharaoh himself. So Genesis 41, I'm going to read from it in a second, and we're going to start from verse 14. But the context of this is that one of the most powerful man in the world at that point, he's had a really bad night and he's had some disturbing dreams. And he's brought all these magicians in and wise men, and no one can help him interpret what these disturbing dreams are all about. And then someone remembers something from a while ago. A prisoner that he was in prison with, the cupbearer, remembers the encounter he had with Joseph and how Joseph helped him and correctly interpreted his dream. So this is where we're going to jump into the story. Genesis 41, 14. So Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. I love that moment. That moment when Joseph was released from the dungeon. He was shaved and changed his clothes. And that's quite an interesting point, because apparently the Egyptian court didn't have any beards. It's an interesting historical thing, isn't it? A lot of the writers that have explored this passage comment that it's an accurate portrayal of the Egyptian court at that point. He was shaved, he changed his clothes, and he came before Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I had a dream and no one can interpret it, but I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." interesting response this time from Joseph. "I cannot do it," Joseph replied to Pharaoh, "but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires." Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "In my dream, I was standing on the bank of the Nile, when out of the river, there came up seven cows, fat and sleek, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, seven other cows came up, scrawny, very ugly and lean. I've never seen such ugly cows in all the land of Egypt." You can almost hear Pharaoh kind of getting a bit proud there, can't you? "The lean, ugly cows ate up the seven fat cows that came up first. But even after they ate them, no one could tell that they had done so. They looked just as ugly as before. And then I woke up. In my dream, I saw seven heads of grain, full and good, growing on a single stalk. And after them, seven other heads sprouted, withered and thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven good heads. And I told this to the magicians, and none of them could explain it to me." So, Joseph's moment as he comes into the courts of the Pharaoh. I wonder what he thought at this point as he was whisked, washed, shaved, and taken into the presence of this important person. It must have felt a little bit surreal for him. A few minutes ago, he was in a dungeon all dirty. And then a minute later, a couple of minutes, an hour later, he's in the most important court, you could argue, in the world at that time. And let's just think about Pharaoh for a moment. Just think about the person that he was. His people treated him as a god. He held supreme power and mastery over everyone. And Joseph's life was literally in his hands as he stood there. A modern day equivalent might be a bit like being taken out of a labour camp and then brought into the presence of President Putin. That's the only example that I could think of what this experience must have been like for Joseph. And I wonder how Joseph felt at that point as he stood there. Was he terrified? Was he hopeful? Was it overwhelming? Or did he feel at last something was happening, that God was up to something? We don't know, do we? But it must have been a real moment, a great significant point in his life that he looked back to in the years ahead. Because everything at this point depends on how he acts and speaks. And it's a moment that would define his life forever. There's a lot at stake for Joseph at this point. You might think in your own lives of those significant moments when life kind of could change. And this is what it says in Genesis 41, now reading from verse 25. "Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, 'The dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads of grain are 7 years. It's all the one, the same dream. The seven lean, ugly cows that came up afterwards are 7 years, and so are the seven worthless heads of grain scorched by the east wind. They are 7 years of famine. It is just as I said to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. 7 years of great abundance are coming throughout the land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow them. Then all the abundance in Egypt will be forgotten, and the famine will ravage the land. The abundance in the land will not be remembered because the famine that follows will be so severe. The reason the dream was given to Pharaoh in two forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon. And now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man to put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming and store the grain up under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in the cities for food. And this food should be held in reserve for the country to be used during the 7 years of famine that will come upon Egypt, so that the country will not be ruined by the famine. The plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, "Can we find anyone like this man, one in whom there is the Spirit of God? And then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." Wow, what a story of rags to riches. It's an amazing story, isn't it? Joseph literally pulled out of the dungeon into this really important role in the kingdom. Yet this story is really helpful for us because it gives us some insights into some of the profound changes that have happened to Joseph's character from when he was 17. Do you remember that very first Sunday when we looked at him as a teenager? To this man of 30, it tells us in the text, that stands before Pharaoh. There's Joseph at 17 and Joseph at 30. So I'm going to get you to do a little bit of work for me this morning as we continue through the sermon. I just want you to gather around your tables or chat to the person next to you. And I want you to see if you can identify some of the changes that you can see in Joseph from the boy Joseph to the man Joseph, and discover how he's matured and changed. So listening to the story today, thinking about the story way back when he was telling the dream, do you remember, to his brothers? If you want to have a quick check back, you can find it in Genesis 37, and that will show you when he was young. So I'm going to give a few minutes, and we'll see between us whether we can find some of these big character changes that have happened in Joseph. Over to you for a few minutes. We can gather some ideas together about the changes that have happened to Joseph. I've got the mic here, the roving mic, so I'll come and find you. Would anybody like to start us off with a suggestion of what's been happening to Joseph? Who's brave and going to go first? Here we go.
In chapter 37, a lot of his phrasing was about him. It was I-based dreams, where when he stands in front of Pharaoh, he says, "It is not I, it is God." Yeah. So I think he's become more reliant in his journey towards the emphasis of in prison of being God formed.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Great start. Any other thoughts? Who wants to add something? There was lots of chat, so I'm sure we've got lots of ideas.
There was one thing we thought was not so much how. Wasn't so much how he had transformed, but what caused him to transform. I mean, this was the second time that he'd been thrown into an enforced imprisonment. His brothers threw him down the well and sold him to slavery. And he never lost sight of that. But one thing we discussed was the fact that when he was speaking to his brothers, he was talking about, "I'm doing this and I'm doing that and I'm doing this and I'm doing that." And now when he goes before Pharaoh, it's not about him, it's about God. And God will explain the dream and God will make this all happen. So there's a humbling, and Henry was reminded of a verse. You said it, I think it's in 1 Peter.
Humble yourselves before God, and in due time you'll
exalt you. Yeah, humble yourselves before God, yeah, and in due time you'll be exalted. And this is what's coming through here.
Yeah, it's a very different character almost, isn't there, between the young and the older Joseph. Does anybody else want to add anything else? Or similar sort of thoughts coming. Anything else that came up with any of your groups? Do you want to say something, Jill?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear much.
Okay. Doesn't matter if you say the same, that's fine. Yeah.
The main thing was this focus on God and Pharaoh. It's very definitely not God has told me, but what is God is telling you, Pharaoh. So his attitude, very different. He's putting the other person centre. So it's grown in sensitivity, yes. Really. Yes. Here is the king, and let him have the honour anyway. I'm sorry if I've repeated.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I think that's a different point that we're drawing out of the same sort of change in his personality, how he's managing that situation. Do you want to?
Well, the big change that I see in those two passages is moving from the dreamer to the interpreter.
Fantastic. I'll add on to mine as well that I had to think about as well.
So I picked up exactly the same as you, that the young Joseph didn't give God credit at all, did he, for his dreams. But the mature Joseph, particularly this passage, it's really clear that God is right at the centre of everything's happening. And then I also picked up about the sensitivity of his delivery, as Jill did. So when he was younger, he was quite insensitive, wasn't he, about the way he shared his gift. But if you notice, the mature Joseph is very careful with his words. And he shows what might be called emotional intelligence with the way that he manages this really quite overwhelming sort of situation. There's a sense of discernment in the way he's weighing things up and using his words. And then I also noticed that the gifts had grown as well. He's not just describing dreams now. He's also interpreting them, and we noticed that in the prison, didn't we? That he kind of, he'd already started to practice and refine that gift when he was imprisoned. And now, at this most important point in his life, it's kind of a gift that he's developed and honed, and he's ready to use it. The other thing that I was reflecting on was, I think he used this situation really wisely, didn't he? He could have come in to the Pharaoh and just complained about the way that he'd been treated, about his injustice and what had happened to him. But he doesn't do that, does he? He uses it as a positive way, a constructive conversation with Pharaoh. He listens really carefully to what Pharaoh's saying before he speaks. And then I think there's also something about his great confidence as he speaks. As I was reading the passage, I got this real sense that he just trusted God to help him. He just knew that God would be there as he was in that situation. There's no hesitancies there about him thinking God's here and he's going to help. And as rightly so, as many of you picked it up, he pointed Pharaoh constantly to God all the time. But that must have meant that he had a really strong sense of God being there and trusting that God would show up when he needed help. So it's a wonderful story that we're following through, that we can learn a lot from, about this man, this young man that's being formed and shaped and transformed into God's man. And he's a man of faith at this point, he's a man of humility, and he's ready to be used by God for his purposes. So that raises the question for us, I think. What type of person are you becoming? As you look at your life today, what type of person are you becoming? Because, you know, we're all becoming someone. The process of being shaped and changed, it happens to all of us, regardless of our stage of life, our beliefs, whether we're a Christian or not. Life is about being shaped and changed. We're not static people. But who's shaping you? Is it the world and the culture around you? Is it other people that are shaping you? Maybe it's your circumstances at the moment. What you watch on television. How you use social media. Is that shaping you? Or is it God, our Father, his Son Jesus, the Holy Spirit, shaping you? Because as believers, followers of Jesus, we're called into this process of being shaped and changed to be like him. That was a process that was at work in Joseph's life. And sometimes as modern Western Christians, we have this idea about faith almost being like a transaction thing. That if I say this prayer and I believe these ideas, if I do certain things, if I go to church, then I'll get into heaven and that's fine. I can just get on with the rest of my life. And of course, God's grace and the work of Jesus on the cross, the eternal life that's given to us, is a free gift. It's an amazing gift that God gives to us. We don't have to work for it. It's there for us. But there's much more, isn't there, to living the Christian life than waiting for eternity to start. Because as Christians, if we don't obediently give ourselves up to God for this transforming process that Joseph was part of, we are just like everyone else. Our life is the same as everyone around us. We don't live a life that's distinctive or different, and we don't mature in our faith. We don't draw closer to Christ. We don't grow. We don't enter into the things that God has for us, because we're full of ourselves and we're not full of Jesus. And you know what? The church is weaker for it. And it compromises the mission that God has for his world, because he invites us to join in with that mission. I'm reading some books at the moment. Some of you know that in my studies I'm looking at discipleship. That's my course at the moment, and I'm finding it very, very challenging, as you can imagine. And one of the books I've been reading is a very new book out called by John Mark Comer. It's called Practicing the Way. And he said this sentence, which I've been thinking a lot about. He says, for Jesus, salvation is less about getting us into heaven, and it's more about getting heaven into us. That's really thought-provoking, isn't it? It's very thought-provoking. And the Bible uses lots of different ways to describe this life of change, of this life of growth and of development. In Genesis, we've seen that for Joseph, there's this term that the Lord was with Joseph, that sense of Joseph journeying and travelling with God very closely. And that might be one way to sort of understand what this process is. There's other words that the Bible uses about God's work in our lives. He uses words like forgiveness, the idea of removing the mess and the sin and starting again. It's almost like a circle, isn't it? That we get challenged, we hear, we understand, and that causes us to respond to Jesus and ask for a fresh start, for forgiveness. And then that means that changes our behaviour and our thoughts, and we start again. We constantly go round this circle of growing and development. It never stops. The Bible uses words like healing, being restored from what's broken inside us and being transformed into something new. That's a lovely image as well, isn't it? And we've thought a lot about the image of being moulded like a potter and his clay during this series. Another sort of visual picture of what God is doing in our lives if we submit to him. It's about a lifetime of making the decision to be obedient and to follow Jesus. It's less like a transaction, a deal with him, and it's more about allowing him to transform us. This is what Paul wrote about this in Corinthians. He said, "And we all who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is Spirit." It's another very challenging verse to think about, this idea that as we come into God's presence, we're being transformed as we allow the Lord to work in our lives and the Spirit to move. And he makes this link, doesn't he, Paul, with Moses. You know, Moses had to go into God's presence. He had to put a veil over his face because of the experience of doing that, of just the overwhelming presence. And then as he came out, there was that veil over his face because people were just affected by the fact that he'd been transformed by being with God. But we don't have to have the veil. That's all gone. Jesus has removed all that. And as we spend time with God by his Spirit, we're being transformed in that process to be like him. The Bible opens up this rich, transforming, healing life for those who follow Jesus, who recognise who he is and what he's done for us, and who decide that they're going to give their lives over to him, to be obedient to him, who realise that we need fixing and our lives changed. People who see the need to learn and to be shaped and to be apprenticed by Jesus. The last few weeks, as I've been thinking about discipleship on my course, I found it very thought-provoking about what's forming me, and if I notice God's at work in my life, do others around me see that happening as well? Do we ask one another if we can see God at work in our lives? I've been reflecting on my own discipleship journey and what it means to act and think and be more like Jesus. And just thinking about that word disciple or apprentice might be another way to think about it. I'm going to invite Ian to come and join me now, because over this series we've been asking or inviting people to come and share their stories a little bit of what it means to follow Jesus. And Ian's very bravely said he'll come and share a little bit of his story about what it's meant for him in his life. So welcome up, Ian. Come and share a little bit about your story. So I'm just going to ask, I said to Ian, I'd ask you just a couple of questions, but this is one that suddenly occurred to me. Were you ever an apprentice when you were learning things? Did you learn from a master?
No, well, I learned things, but I wasn't an apprentice or anything. But
you've always been in a work where you've learned from other people, have you?
Yeah, exactly.
And just observed from them as well. Because I think Joseph was going through that process as he was growing. But how did you come to faith?
Well, it's a bit of a story, really. I never went to church except for marriage, obviously christening, and obviously shame funeral. Funeral was an important part of their lives.
Yeah.
And then you start thinking, well, there's bits in between.
Yeah.
And then I often thought, Sunday, singing, perhaps I ought to go to church. Something was probably pushing me to get to church.
Yeah.
I don't know what.
Yeah, yeah.
And so eventually I went to church, the Holy Trinity. And it's okay. And then we had a time when my granddaughter was want to be christened.
Yeah.
And he said no, because she doesn't live in the village. And I thought, well, you're pushing somebody away and you want bring people into church, I thought. Anyway, at that time, I got a bit peeved about it, but okay, I still went. And I know some people remember, we went to the service in the pub, car park, in the garden, and Grant said, well, if people won't come to church, let the church come to the people. So we had a service in the garden, which was very successful. And Richard spoke, that's interesting, and then Sean got up and spoke, and I listened to him, very good, and he said, give it a try. I thought, that's about right. And of course, Kathleen had been saying to me, go to the Baptist church, they're nice there. She was right, because she used to come with her mother, because her mother was blind, she'd bring her mother. And then, of course, Sean saying, give it a try. And I thought, well, I'll give it a try. So I came through that door and it felt right, it felt good, and I was made so welcome, and it sort of got better and better and better, so it's more exciting now than it was then.
Hallelujah.
So draw your own conclusions of what started me coming to church, with a little bit of help from Kathleen and Sean. Chucked in, so that's why I'm here.
And I know when we were talking about this, you were saying that for you, your journey's been quite slow. And
It wasn't one big push.
It just kept growing and growing.
Made me think. I can remember, I understand now, well, I didn't at the time, that something was pushing me to go to church.
Fantastic.
And it worked.
That's really interesting. Just to, one of the fascinating things about sharing testimony is it, you just learn that God speaks to us in such unique ways and brings us to Christ with our different personalities. And it's just lovely, isn't it, to hear different stories of how faith has grown. For some, it's an experience that just happens and there's a radical change. But for others, it's really important that they just have a slow process of just getting closer to Jesus.
Slowly but surely.
Absolutely, fantastic. Okay. So is there one thing that you could share where it's really made a difference to you, being a follower of Jesus?
I think it's made a difference all through, not just one spot, just all through, probably the one spot when I came through the door.
Yes.
That was probably the big difference, because I sort of had that feeling. And that was it, you know. So
there's a really strong sense of being drawn, isn't there, that I can hear from your story of being drawn, which is really lovely. That's very biblical, so that's fantastic.
Okay.
And just one more thing. Is there anything you want to share with us as a church or encourage us at this point in our journey as a church?
I don't know, encourage us, but it's encouraged me being here.
Yeah.
So I think it must be the same for other people.
Yeah.
I can't say as I can encourage other people to come, but that's what's happened to me.
Yeah. And your story does encourage us. Mm-hmm. It's really important, isn't it, to hear each other's stories. So thank you.
Okay,
thank you very much for doing that. That's brilliant. So it has been really interesting as we've gone through this series, just listening to different people's stories and how they've changed. And we can definitely see that happening in Joseph's life, can't we? And how encouraging for us to hear. We never know what impact we have on people's life. Sean, isn't it great to hear that something you probably said a long time ago made such a difference? And we have to just give that, don't we, to the Lord for our friends and family, that you just never, ever know the impact that a word, a prayer might have had. So an encouragement to us all just to keep going, to keep running the race. And that's really helpful. Thank you, Ian, for that. So I just want to sort of finish off really just by thinking a little bit about this idea of a discipleship or apprenticeship. I'm not going to talk about it a lot this morning because we're going to have a series in the autumn after I've been through my studies. I'm hoping that I'll be able to condense that down and I'll be able to share that and we'll be able to explore that together as a church as we go into the autumn. But I found this quote quite helpful just to get us thinking about what it might look like to be an apprentice of Jesus. So this is a bit of a taster for what is to come. You might want to reflect on this, but Jesus drew people to him, just a bit like Ian was talking about, the idea of inviting people to follow. But that invite also required a decision from them to follow as well. And there's something in about a disciple, about being like Jesus, what does that mean for us? Then becoming like him, what does that mean for us? And then doing as he did. And so, as I say, in the autumn, we're going to spend a bit more time unpacking that and looking at it in a little bit more detail. But for today, we're going to leave the story of Joseph as a leader. At this point in the story, he's been described as wise and discerning by Pharaoh, nonetheless, himself. And Joseph lives up to this description, doesn't he? He makes strategic and life-saving decisions for the people of Egypt. And is appointed by Pharaoh to this hugely significant job, which is thousands of people's lives, really, that he's taken responsibility for. The whole of the nation's future has been placed into Joseph's very capable hands. And as we sort of leave the story at this point, I think I just wanted to make the point that it shows how our work is important to God. There's some of us that are still in working roles. And this story of Joseph shows that God used him really powerfully in his work roles. We talk a lot about front lines, don't we, and we have done in the past. Those places in our life where we're out and about with our family, our neighbours, it might be our leisure activities. But particularly for Joseph, for him, it was his work. So for those of us that are working, it's just that word of encouragement that God is with you. God was with Joseph. God is with you as you go into your work environments. For those of us that volunteer, for example, in charities that do work in that way, it's not always paid work. God is with you as you go into those situations. And God used Joseph in his frontline place, and he saved a nation, not just one nation, but many people through his actions and behaviour. And Joseph settles down. If you want to read the rest of that chapter at home, it's lovely. He kind of integrates into Egyptian culture, which is quite interesting. He takes an Egyptian name and he marries an Egyptian wife and they have children. But the other thing that passage tells us is that he remained a follower of the one true God. He never compromised in his faith. But there does seem to be a level of contentment for Joseph at this point in his story. It's like he's found his shape, maybe healed from some of the experiences that he had in the past. And you can see that in the names that he gives his children. Two boys, and the first one is called "It's Because God Has Made Me Forget All My Troubles and My Father's Household." Isn't that interesting? That's quite a long name, isn't it? But that's the first son, the meaning of his name. And the second son was "Because God Made Me Fruitful in the Land of My Suffering." Isn't that interesting? That's the name of his second son. So that's where we're going to leave Joseph today. And we've still got a bit more of the story to come. And God hasn't finished with him yet. And we're going to learn a bit more in small groups. Christy's going to wrap the series up for us the following Sunday after that as we gather as a whole church. But I hope you're enjoying this story. I'm learning a huge amount from it. What an example Joseph is to us of a man who uses his gifts and grows and is shaped by God. Let's just pause for a minute, because we're going to move now into a time of communion.